Thank you, Michael. So yeah, I'd like to talk about visual processing in the retina, and in particular how to what extent the rules that the retina applies to the visual image, to processing the visual image, change dynamically. But I also take the opportunity to review a little bit what the retina does, and maybe also why, or at least get to speculations about why it does that. Now, my experience with these workshop talks is that one never gets to the last slide of the prepared presentation. So I want to start with the last slide. This is a group of people that's responsible for the work that I'm going to talk about. And in particular, Toji Hosoya, who was a postdoc with me until he left last fall. He's now at Riken in Tokyo. And Steve Backus, who was a postdoc and is now at Stanford. So I know the retina has come up before in this workshop, so I'm going to be very brief on the introduction. The retina, you know, is the film in the camera of the eye. It's this layered neural tissue at the back of the eye whose job is to convert the image that's projected by the optics into a neural signal that can be processed by the rest of the nervous system, and then to begin processing that image, actually operating on that image already, extracting from it certain features, and we'll talk about what those are, and ultimately to transmit the information about those features through the optic nerve to the brain. Now, if you were to cut out a little segment of the retina like this, you put it under a microscope, you might see a structure as in this drawing here from Polyak's work. The outermost layer of neurons are the photoreceptors. These are cells that actually absorb light and convert it into a neural signal and transmit that to bipolar cells, second-order neurons in this layer. And bipolar cells, in turn, make synapses onto retinal ganglion cells, the output neurons of the retina. Each retinal ganglion cell has an axon that runs through the optic nerve to the brain. So there are roughly three layers of neurons, but in addition to this vertical straight-through flow of information, there's also quite a bit of lateral processing at this outer layer of synapses by neurons called horizontal cells. They make connections to photoreceptors and bipolar cells. And at this inner layer here by neurons called amacrine cells, they make connections to bipolar and retinal ganglion cells. And as a result of all this wiring, the retina actually performs a good amount of image processing already on the raw visual input. And this is somewhat unusual for a sensory system to actually place a lot of processing outside of the brain. All other senses, taste, olfaction, somatosense, sensation, hearing, pretty much run the receptor signals directly into the brain where they get processed. Not so in vision. In vision, we have this big processor way out front, outside of the skull, and that begins to work on the sensor information. And you might ask, why is vision different? Why is it pushed all this processing? We're talking in your eye, we're talking about 200 million neurons or so. Why is that pushed all the way out front into the periphery? here's a crude statistic. if you look at the number of neurons in the visual system, that at any given stage represent the entire visual information, we have about 10 to the 8 photoreceptors at this outermost layer of the retina. And then at the output of the retina, we have about 10 to the 6 optic nerve fibers. And so these are retinal ganglion cell signals going to the brain. And then when the signal hits the visual cortex back here, the representation expands dramatically into 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10 cells that operate on the information that they get from 10 to the 6. Retinal ganglion cells. So the optic nerve, the output of the retina, is, at least in terms of number of neurons, the thinnest part of the visual system by far. It's the place in the visual pathway where all the visual information is contained in the smallest number of neurons. Now, this a bottleneck in terms of neuron number translates into a bottleneck in terms of information capacity as well. So if you think about the capacity of to represent visual information by the population of 10 to the 8 photoreceptors, and compare that to the capacity of the output, these spiking neurons sending action potentials to the brain, depending on how you juggle the numbers, you can convince yourself that the ratio is about 1 or 5%. So it means that of the raw information that hits the photoreceptors, the retina must reject somehow, must discard the vast majority, and it can send only a tiny fraction of that onto the brain. You can argue about lossless compression. So in fact, part of my talk will be about how, in fact, what is the information sources, namely the natural environment, don't actually fill the capacity of the photoreceptor channel, and therefore the much of this can be achieved via lossless compression, but there's lossy compression as well, and we'll talk about that.
I'm still wondering where numbers like that come from. I mean, are you taking into account correlation in the natural scenes?
So that's what I was trying to say right now. This number here is the capacity of one photoreceptor times 100 million.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, natural images don't make use of that capacity, if you want, and in fact, a lot of my talk will be about just that. Nevertheless, the retina has to sense the image with senses the image with these 100 million pixels, even though the source of the information doesn't actually fill the capacity of that channel. Yeah.
So, I guess what you're saying here is that the 100-to-1 compression neuron number is not somehow mysteriously made up for by very different information capacities of the element.
That's right.
So then I want to ask a question about the neuron numbers. If I only counted the cones, the discrepancy wouldn't be so dramatic, right?
That's right. So of these photoreceptors, about 6 or 7 million are cone photoreceptors. The others are rod photoreceptors. And in daytime vision, we mostly use cone photoreceptors. Probably most of the time we're awake.
Right. So the image of the optic nerve as a dramatic bottleneck is not correct at in the daytime.
In daytime, the bottleneck is smaller, maybe a factor of 5 to 10. Yeah.
But at night time, the information
isn't
there, so maybe it's never following on the real time.
Well, so
you have to do massive area
summation. That's right. Well, in nighttime, you do have the numbers bottleneck certainly, but again, you can ask whether the information.
If you have correlations with the image, you might guess that
the source. Right. But, and I mean, part of the challenge that evolution has faced in designing retinas is that it has to deal with all these conditions. Yeah, it has to deal with the low light limit and the high light limit, and largely I'll talk about strategies that the retina shows for dealing with this range of conditions. One approach that the retina uses to, you know, actually efficiently discard information or to select certain precious features that it sends on to the brain is a whole range of adaptations. And in general, what we mean by that is that the retina changes the rules by which it processes the visual image depending on the conditions, depending on the statistics of the environment. And so I'd like to review a few of those that are very familiar, and then tell you about some more recent experiments that suggest that actually this principle extends quite a bit. So one type of adaptation that we're more familiar with is light adaptation. The light intensity over the course of a day varies by a lot, 9 or 10 log units, and that's because our planet rotates about its axis and the sun goes up and down once a day. So the overall light intensity that falls into the eye varies by maybe 10 log units, but at any given time of day, it varies by only about 1 log unit or a couple. And so at any given time of day, the relevant range of light intensities is about 1 or 2 log units. Now, a brute force solution to dealing with this would be to have sensors of with different sensitivities, so that at noon you work with photoreceptors that are 10 to the tenfold less sensitive than the photoreceptors you use at midnight. And that would require you to have basically a little retina for each of these log units that are within the within the range of diurnal range of intensities. But instead, an efficient coder of these kinds of signals would actually adjust its response function such that when the range of light intensities is down at the very low end, it uses a stimulus response function that is centered on the, on this range, and then when the intensities are very bright at noon, it moves the stimulus response function over. And that's in fact what the retina does. And it does so with two different strategies. One type of adaptation the retina uses for this is I would call evolutionary adaptation, in that it actually has two types of photoreceptors that are responsible for different parts of this large range of light intensities. Yeah. The rod photoreceptors and cone photoreceptors are differ in their sensitivity to light by a large factor, about 1,000 to 10,000 fold. here's a measurement of the of a rod photoreceptor's response to a single photon. It actually has a response of about 1 millivolt, so quite easily measurable. The response lasts for a long time, about a second. So this is in very dim lights. This is how the photoreceptor operates. A cone photoreceptor, by comparison, has a single photon response only of about a microvolt, and it's also much faster, as you can see, less than a tenth of a second integration time. And so by splitting the range up between these two photoreceptor types, the retina can cover, can begin to cover this large range of light intensities. That still leaves about 4 or 5 log units for each of the photoreceptor types. And that is dealt with by a dynamic form of light adaptation. So each of these photoreceptors, both the rods and the cones, change their sensitivity to light depending on the mean light level that they experience. Here's an example of the single photon response of a rod photoreceptor at different light levels. So when you turn up the light intensity and deliver a flash of light, the single photon causes, in this case, only half the response, and then the response gets gradually weaker. It also gets faster with the mean light level. So this is a dynamic adaptation. The individual receptor cell changes the way it responds to the light stimulus. And similarly for cones, again, as we raise the mean light level on which we deliver light flashes, the single photon response becomes smaller and smaller. And so together, these two mechanisms, this kind of evolutionary adaptation of having two receptor systems and the dynamic adaptation of each receptor, are able to span the wide range of light intensities. And they do so quite efficiently, resulting in actually in this horizontal sliding of the stimulus response curve that I showed in my cartoon earlier. This goes far beyond the cartoon. Here's a measurement from the 1960s of cat ganglion cell responses to flashes of different intensities. And each of these curves is obtained at a different background level of intensity. And as you can see, this is a logarithmic scale here, number of spikes fired vertically. And as we change the background level of intensity, the stimulus response function simply slides over along this log scale. So one can see this is a, you know, it's a beautiful way of dealing with this problem of having a very large range of light intensities. One can also see how it discards information. Because when the cell fires at 200 hertz, I don't know what the absolute light level was anymore. Yeah? If I'm sitting at the other end of the optic nerve, and I get a 200 hertz response from this particular retinal ganglion cell, I know that a flash of light happened, but I don't know whether it was a dim flash on a dim background or a bright flash on a bright background. So the retina, or these ganglion cells at least, have discarded information about the absolute light level. And to very good approximation, they encode only relative intensities.
So Marcus, there are other pathways in which the mean luminance level is encoded, right?
There's actually a very rare class of ganglion cells that does that. So the vast majority of ganglion cells, 99% or so, will show this kind of behavior under light adaptation. And there's a rare class of ganglion cells that seems to be there just to tell the brain what the mean luminance level is for things like controlling the aperture, controlling the pupil, and controlling the circadian rhythms. Yeah. But they have poor spatial resolution, and there are few of them, so they're not, they can't be used for fine spatial or temporal visual processing. Okay, another statistic of natural scenes that vary slowly is the contrast. And by contrast, I mean the sort of overall range of light intensities that's present in any given scene. here's a picture, for example, of downtown Los Angeles on what the locals call a good day. And here's a picture on a bad day. And I was able to confirm recently that these still happen, although things have improved a lot over the past 20 years. I don't know what California has done with controlling emissions, but since the 80s, things have really cleaned up a lot. Anyway, just a couple of weeks ago, we had one of these. As you can see, the mean light intensity is about the same under these conditions, but the range of light intensities that hits the retina is quite different in this image. From that image, it's a narrow range in one case and a broad range in the other case, centered on about the same mean intensity. Now, an efficient coder of such images might again adjust its stimulus response function such that it spans the whole range, this wide range under high contrast conditions, and spans a somewhat narrow range under low contrast conditions. And in fact, the retina does just that. Here's an example from an experiment with salamander retina. This, I think, is Mike's work. where we applied a random flicker stimulus, uniform in space, varying with this random waveform in time. And in different trials of the experiment, we changed the contrast of the stimulus. So we used the same random flicker series, but changed the amplitude about the mean. Kept the mean the same, but changed the amplitude from about a standard deviation of 2% to a standard deviation of 35%. What we're seeing here is the firing rate of a retinal ganglion cell in response to these stimuli. And what surprised us was that the firing rate, the response is actually approximately the same to all these stimuli. It's a little weaker maybe to 2% than to 35%, but the ganglion cell fires at pretty much exactly the same times under all these conditions. It's as though it was adjusting its sensitivity to whatever the range of intensities is that occurs in the stimulus. Yeah. Notice, for example, that it responds to this little blip in the 2% condition by firing this burst of spikes, whereas under 35% condition, there are lots of little blips of that magnitude that don't cause any spikes. So obviously, the ganglion cell or the retina has somehow rescaled its sensitivity to the new range of light intensities. And we spent some time looking into this phenomenon and found, for example, that it takes some time for the system to perform this adaptation, typically on the order of 5 or 10 or 15 seconds. Here's an example of measuring the mean firing rate of a retinal ganglion cell. As we switch from a low contrast to a high contrast flicker sequence, the firing rate jumps up initially, but then gradually relaxes to a lower level, and these relaxations are a sign, are one indication that the system is changing its rules, it's changing the way it operates, and this happens on a time scale of 5 or 10 seconds. We also spend some time probing where this happens by sticking individual electrodes into the retina and recording from different neurons and asking in each case, does this neuron already rescale its sensitivity? Does the contrast adaptation happen at these cells? And we found that a little bit of it happens in bipolar cells, and you can also see a signature of it in amacrine cells, but actually the full effect, this full-blown rescaling of the sensitivity occurs only in the retinal ganglion cells, and we think it's a result somehow of the interaction of bipolar and amacrine cells at the synapse. And how this might happen, I'll talk about a little later, I'll get to a little later in the talk. Yeah.
So
contrast adaptation?
Yeah. There was a slight increase in firing rate.
Yeah.
Is it proportional to Weber?
So I don't know if Weber's law is the right reference here, but in some sense, perfect contrast adaptation would produce a completely invariant response. right? The system would scale its sensitivity down proportionally to the contrast, so that the output is invariant with respect to contrast. And that's not what happens. So you saw in that example a couple of slides ago that the response is maybe twofold lower under these conditions than under these conditions. So there's not perfect rescaling, but the contrast is different by 16-fold, and the response is different by 2-fold. So there's some remaining contrast dependence in the response. But again, I would say this type of adaptation discards information because the brain, for example, couldn't tell the difference between these two conditions. In each case, it gets information only about the excursions of the light intensity relative to the average excursion and not about the absolute contrast. Yeah. So that's something that, I'm harping on this, but the point that adaptation generally incurs, goes hand in hand with the loss of information. And that we can view adaptation, perhaps an alternate way of thinking about it, is actually as a strategy to extract from the visual, from the raw visual signal, a smaller set of features that are actually important and discard others. Yeah?
Do you know if this adaptation is something that happens locally or globally? Like you have the bottom half of your retina looking at a high contrast tree or something, and the top half looking at a low contrast sky. Is the top half going to adapt separately from the bottom?
Yes. Yeah. So the adaptation is fairly local, and this has been studied also in Dick Maslin's lab and by Frederica to some extent. It seems that the adaptation can happen on the scale of the receptive fields of bipolar and amacrine cells. So, in other words, if you took a little spot on the retina and manipulated only its contrast, then that would affect neurons that are within reach of about an amacrine cell receptive field, a few hundred microns in practice. Yeah?
So, to Alex's question, maybe worth pointing out in the sequence that you show where you're changing the contrast from 35% down to 2%, right? Somewhere around there, there's a noise floor, right? I mean, the signals of 35% contrast, those excursions are very much larger than the noise in the photoreceptors
yeah.
that are feeding this thing. So,
yeah.
Whereas somewhere up there, that's not true anymore.
Yeah, actually, we were surprised that it's not here, but at somewhat lower contrast still,
right.
Yeah.
The point is that if you think in terms of the picture that you showed of how sort of an optimal strategy is to
right.
scale things, that's only true if the noise level is negligible.
Yeah.
And so you expect that somewhere at low contrast that has to stop.
Right.
If you want that explanation.
Yeah, or at some point, in other words, the contrast comes from noise and photoreceptors rather than the signal, the light that you put into the retina.
Yeah. The filter actually slows down at lower contrast,
mm-hmm.
more temporal integration.
Yeah, you can see a little bit of that here in that these events become somewhat broader.
So, Marcus, thinking about sort of where this information then goes to the balance cortex, if you were thinking mammals, you see those same kinds of features in different brain regions, and it's not clear to me to what extent some of it arises from the retina versus different origins. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that? Are they similar as you start to look through the pathways?
Well, there's there's sort of a theme to these phenomena in that they were first discovered in psychophysics. So you find that human subjects, of course, have light adaptation in their visual perception. They also have contrast adaptation. They show various other forms of pattern adaptation that I'll get to. And then people started poking around in cortex to see, can we see these effects in cortical neurons? And they did. And the conclusion historically was that this is what cortex does. We see these effects in cortical neurons. There were some half-hearted attempts to look for them in the lateral geniculate. But more and more, there's now a realization that a lot of this is already beginning in the retina. Light adaptation, obviously, we've known that for some time. Contrast adaptation also. And as I'll show in a moment, pattern adaptation as well as starting in the retina. My guess is that every part of the visual pathway does its bit, maybe using some of the same strategies, some of the same rules for operating on the inputs and extracting features for the outputs, discarding features that are predictable or common or constant and so on. And so as you send the signal through many such stages, it becomes more and more compressed in some sense. Although at the cortex, again, you're dealing with a different phenomenology. The number of neurons is huge. There's no real need to compress the information into few neurons, but you may want to extract relevant features for computation, association or storage, etc. Yeah.
If adaptation is very local, how can adaptation to intensity be very different from adaptation to contrast, especially if you have a coarse pattern?
So the adaptation to intensity that I talked about happens in individual photoreceptors. There is also a component that happens later on in the network, although that may not be distinguishable actually from the mechanisms of contrast adaptation. But the individual photoreceptors don't do this. Yeah, if you record from a cone photoreceptor, and we've done this during these stimuli, the response is 16 times bigger here than here. Yeah, there's no rescaling of the sensitivity. So there are different mechanisms responsible for light adaptation and contrast adaptation. Contrast adaptation happens later in the network.
And it's only a few seconds. The time scale for long is very
slow. So this adaptation happens in a few seconds. Light adaptation is quite a bit faster, actually. So in a rod photoreceptor, a cone photoreceptor, when you turn up the mean light level and then start to probe it with flashes, you can see the effects within a few tenths of a second. There's another slow component to it. Generally speaking, these processes are multi-time scale. They're not well described as single exponentials. And so when I say a few seconds, that's a crude simplification. Yeah? Well, with contrast, I'm not so sure. With absolute light level, we're actually very poor at estimating absolute light levels, right? I mean, that's why photographers have to carry light meters around. Whereas we can sense differences in light intensity at an edge or at a point in time to within a percent or a few percent, we can estimate the absolute light level only to within a factor of 2 or 4. Yeah. And I think something similar is true for contrast, it's actually difficult to estimate the absolute contrast of a grating, even though we're very sensitive to relative relative light intensity within the grating.
Yeah, I mean, it actually turns out that an interesting feature of those responses is that if you were to look at the average firing rate of the neuron in sort of, 5-second windows or something like that, then it actually is proportional to contrast.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something that Bill and Adrian have suggested as well, that there are some statistics of the spike trains that somehow convey the statistics of the visual stimulus to the brain, in addition to these kind of normalized output that give you relative contrast or relative light intensity.
In general, I guess when you say that something's adaptive, it's thus created an ambiguity in the representation. The signal, there are three possibilities, right? One is there's some other neuron that resolves the ambiguity. Another is that actually the ambiguity is real and you can't tell. And the other is that while you focused on the ambiguity exists at a sort of short time scale, you step back and look at longer time scale spike range to resolve the ambiguity. And the answer is probably yes. There's some component of all three of those
in those cases. But, a lot of visual illusions are based on one or another effect of adaptation, and the visual illusion is nothing but subject reporting an ambiguity, right? Two physically different stimuli have the same percept, and oftentimes you can trace the origin of the illusion to some effect of adaptation, or an after effect. Okay. So in both these cases, light adaptation and contrast adaptation, the retina sort of makes use of the fact that there's a certain statistic of the visual stimulus varies only very slowly and doesn't need to be tracked from millisecond to millisecond, but maybe gets reported to the brain once a minute, or maybe not at all. But that the absolute light, the mean light intensity varies very slowly, and the contrast, the overall contrast in the scene varies slowly. So that allows the visual system to kind of normalize that out, discard it, and operate on the moment-to-moment and point-to-point variations that are more interesting. But there are other statistics of the visual world that also vary slowly or not at all. For example, if you look at any image taken from the natural world, two nearby points in the image tend to have the same intensity. So if I plot the intensity of one pixel against the intensity of its neighboring pixel, they're almost all these pairs are almost on the diagonal, except for a few that are off the diagonal. Now, the ones that are off the diagonal are the interesting ones, of course. Those are the edges of objects where the intensity suddenly changes. So in terms of the utility for behavior and for visually guided aspects of behavior, these pixel pairs that are off the diagonal are actually very relevant. And yet most of them are right on the diagonal. So if you had an encoder that had multiple pixels available to send to the brain, it would be very inefficient for neuron 1 and neuron 2 to both report the raw intensities at their locations because they're almost always the same. So instead, you could have neuron 1 report the intensity and neuron 2 report the difference of the intensity, this variable here that goes along this axis, because those differences tend to be small. And they also tend to be the important and relevant features in the visual image. So as you probably know, that's exactly what retinal ganglion cells do. They report the difference in intensity between neighboring points in space. So here's a classic example from Rodick and Stone, where they stimulated a cat retina with a thin bar of light and moved the bar across to different positions, and then plotted the response of a ganglion cell as a function of the position of the bar. And there was a sweet spot here, the receptive field center, where the ganglion cell fired very rapidly. But if you place the bar to the left or to the right of that, the ganglion cell actually stops firing. It suppresses the ongoing activity. It's a negative response. And then if you move further away, there's no response at all. Yeah. So the response is positive at the center, negative in these two adjacent regions in the so-called surround of the receptive field. Effectively, the ganglion cell subtracts the intensity here from the intensity in the surround. Yeah? So it really reports the spatial difference in intensity rather than the raw intensity at any given point in the image. You can make a similar argument in the time domain. Natural scenes are very strongly correlated in time. If you take two successive frames from a movie, and just ask where in the picture does the intensity change either up or down, you find that there's a very tiny number of pixels where the intensity increases and another tiny number of pixels where it decreases. So again, because of the structure of the physical world, it's made of objects. The objects don't move very fast. Most of the points in the image retain their intensity over time. And again, the ones that don't are the interesting ones. In this case, they outline the moving object. Yeah. And so if you plotted the intensity at time one against intensity at time two and histogram those pairs, you'd find again that most of the pairs lie along the diagonal. It would be inefficient for an encoder of signals like that to report the signal at every point in time independently. Instead, it would be more efficient to report the differences of the signal in time, because those differences are small and they tend to be relevant. And again, you find that that's exactly what retinal ganglion cells do. This is an example of temporal integration functions, or sometimes they're called reverse correlation functions, of the macaque retinal ganglion cells to a flickering stimulus. Mike, did you talk about what reverse correlations how to interpret these and so on?
It had already been talked about.
Okay. All right. So, again, briefly, you can think of this as the weighting function by which the ganglion cell weights the intensity prior to deciding whether to fire a spike or not. And so, in this case, the ganglion cell is excited by light about 30 or 40 milliseconds prior to the spike, but it's actually inhibited by light at some earlier point in time. It has a biphasic integration function, a biphasic kernel, if you want. And so it effectively takes the difference of the light intensity a short time ago minus the light intensity some longer time ago. Yeah. Here's another retinal ganglion cell. This is an off-type neuron. So it's inhibited by light a short time ago and excited by light some longer time ago. Again, the biphasic integration function. The two lobes cancel almost perfectly. So it's an almost perfect differentiator of light intensity. So these two features of retinal ganglion cell responses have been cast into the framework of predictive coding, and this is something that Simon was involved in, and earlier Atneev and Barlow have talked about the same thing with different words. But I really like the framework of predictive coding, and the idea is this: on average in natural scenes, the light intensity doesn't vary with space. Neighboring points have the same intensity. So what the retina tries to do is it measures the intensity at the neighboring points, makes a prediction for what the intensity is likely to be here, and then encodes the difference between the measured intensity and the predicted value. Yeah. So you can think of the visual system as adopting the null hypothesis that the environment is flat, creating from that null hypothesis a prediction for the local point in space, and encoding only the difference from that prediction. Yeah. So this is a strategy for coding that engineers have used effectively, and one can think about the visual system as adopting the same strategy. Similarly, in time, the null hypothesis of the visual system is that things don't change in time. The pixel intensity stays constant, so the ganglion cell develops a prediction from what the intensity is going to be from previous time points and subtracts that from the actual measured intensity and reports only this difference. And so you can think about this as a strategy for compression of the visual image that's based on a predictive rule that and the null hypothesis that things are constant in space and constant in time. So what are the features of this kind of coding? Well, for one, it actually suppresses the predominant and predictable aspects of natural scenes. So for example, a spatially uniform stimulus will receive very little space in this coding scheme, right? The ganglion cells will essentially not fire. Temporally uniform stimulus will again receive very little output signal as a result. So these predictable patterns get suppressed, and it enhances the sort of unexpected, unpredicted features. Those are the points, for example, the edges of objects where nearby points of different intensity, or the points where that change in time and that typically outline the edges of moving objects. And the way this is thought of generally is as an evolutionary adaptation, right? I mean, the physical world has had this structure for a long time. It's made up of objects with finite extent and finite speed. And therefore, evolution has been able to devise this coding strategy in order to extract the few relevant features. Now, this kind of strategy works well in the average visual scene, but there are many visual environments where it might break down because the spatial or temporal statistics are different from the average. So for example, on sand or gravel, you might have a lot of high spatial frequencies, and so the actual local changes, the differences in intensity might be much greater than in the average visual image from the natural world. If you're in a forest or in a field of tall grass, you might have a lot of vertical orientation, a lot of vertical structure, and so that changes the statistics, it changes the rules for prediction a lot. Or if you're moving around as many animals do, that creates optic flow on the retina, and that optic flow introduces a lot of spatial and temporal, spatial-temporal correlations that again change the statistics of the signal, and would actually lead you to a different kind of predictive coding. So let's think about a couple of examples. In the average visual world, these center surround receptive fields work great, where the ganglion cell encodes the difference between intensity in the center and intensity in the surrounding region. But in the forest, it doesn't work that way. In the forest, you can predict the local intensity from the intensity up on top or below that point, but you can't necessarily predict it from the intensity left and right. So the best predictive encoder for scenes from the forest or from tall grass would actually have receptive fields like this. The ganglion cell would develop a prediction for the local intensity from what's on top and below and subtract that. Similarly, in the average visual scene, space and time factor approximately, so you can do this spatial center surround processing and temporal biphasic integration, but if you're walking around and you have systematic optic flow on the retina, that introduces a very different spatial-temporal structure. And now the intensity at one point on the retina is well predicted by the intensity at a different point earlier in time, because that point's going to move over here. Yeah? So if you want to apply predictive coding, you would use a different strategy. You would actually use receptive fields that are slanted in space-time like this, so that this point over here makes a prediction for that point later. So the question is, does the retina actually follow predictive coding in situations where the rules that you ought to apply for predictive coding are different, because you're spending some significant time in a visual environment that's structured differently? And so our question was whether these center surround and biphasic temporal responses, are they hardwired, are they really strictly evolutionary adaptations to the average environment, or can they be manipulated dynamically? And so the experiment we did is to expose the retina to different environments in which we manipulate the structure of spatial-temporal or spatial-temporal correlations and ask whether the receptive fields of ganglion cells change. And in particular, do they change in a way that makes sense in the context of predictive coding? So here's an example of such an experiment in which we introduced an environment with a preferred orientation. Yeah. So the stimulus here is a flickering horizontal grating. So horizontal bars and a flickering counterphase with a Gaussian intensity distribution. And we apply this for about 10 seconds. And then we probe the retina. We probe the responses of retinal ganglion cells with a brief probe stimulus. And that contains both horizontal and vertical components to it. And then we adapt the retina again, but to a vertical environment. And after that, follow up again with a probe stimulus to see how sensitive the ganglion cells are to one or the other type of stimulus. And the idea here is that if the retina performed some adaptive coding, if it actually changed its receptive field properties, then you ought to qualitatively see this kind of effect. You should find that the kind of stimulus you're exposing the retina to should get suppressed. Predictive coding would actually remove, would suppress the response to that kind of stimulus and enhance the sensitivity to stimuli that are different, that are unexpected, that are not predictable. Yeah? So in this particular context, we would expect that adaptation to the horizontal stimulus would lead to low sensitivity to horizontal gratings and high sensitivity to vertical gratings, whereas adaptation to the vertical stimulus should then enhance sensitivity to horizontal and suppress sensitivity to vertical. You'll see in a moment the ganglion cell receptive field is about, the receptive field center is about this size. These tiles in the experiment I'll show you were about 200 microns, and receptive field center, you know, depending on how far you go out, might be 400 microns in diameter.
But what does it mean that those cells actually change their position? Since they can solve different situations?
So on average, these ganglion cell receptive fields are circular. But what you find is that after adaptation to one or the other environment, they are no longer circular. They become oriented. And they become oriented in the anti-Hebbian way. If you expose them to a horizontal environment, they become vertically oriented and vice versa. By default, in the absence of adaptation, they are not line detectors. They're not orientation selective. Okay, so just to show you an example of what happens, this is for an individual retinal ganglion cell, sensitivity to horizontal grating versus sensitivity to a vertical grating. This one, Alex, I have to reverse myself immediately, is slightly orientation selective. So it has a slight preference for horizontal over vertical. But if you now adapt to a vertical grating, the sensitivity to the horizontal gets increased, whereas the sensitivity to the vertical decreases. Yeah, so adaptation to this environment suppresses the sensitivity to these kinds of stimuli. If you go back to that environment, it suppresses the sensitivity to horizontal and enhances sensitivity to vertical.
Marcus, how do we think about things like contrast in this kind of domain? I mean, is there a sort of a new set of axes for contrast? Is contrast something that's...
Well, so on a formal level, you can think of the stimulus variables we manipulate here as covariances between two points in space or two points in time. All the stimuli I'll show you have the same mean intensity, the same local contrast, but they differ in their covariances between points in space or points in space and time. Yeah. So on a formal level, you might say this is adaptation to correlation. On the other hand, and then in that context, the local contrast is an autocovariance, right? So it's just be a special case of this stimulus statistic. Yeah? And the mechanism I'm going to propose at the end, if I get there, is one that actually would explain or incorporate adaptation to contrast as well.
I'll just make a comment. There's still great difficulty defining contrast because the strict mathematical definition, which is you take the mean over the whole image, is totally useless because there are local differences in the mean. So therefore you have to take a local mean, and the local mean you pick depends on which characteristics of the signal you want to pick out and what the statistics of the signal are. So contrast is actually, sounds very concrete, but in real terms it's actually rather vague.
Actually, as long as we're going to keep Marcus on his slide for a while, I wondered whether there was a connection. So I was wondering when I saw this sort of intrinsic orientation selectivity, to what extent it might just be a coincidence of how you sample the grid. You know, so if you only have a few squares covering a cell's receptive field, then depending on exactly how it's centered, you might just be stimulating it more strongly.
Yeah.
In which case, it's just because the... just because of that detail, it's basically the one orientation grading is higher contrast.
Yeah, that's something we worried about. And so in all these experiments, we did a control where we moved the grating stimulus around randomly on a fine grid. So the edges of the bars are not always in the same place, but they get jittered around.
So a cell like this, where you've seen intrinsic preference, if you just do like a flickering checkerboard receptor field method, is it an object?
Yeah, in fact, I think I have that. So this is the flickering checkerboard receptive field map, and you know, if you want, you can see a little bit of orientation to that receptive field. But the important thing is that receptive field changes. So if you look at the four different regions within this receptive field map, and you ask what happens to the sensitivity, the light sensitivity in these four different regions. As a result of adaptation, you find that, you know, in particular, this back row of pixels gets enhanced and the front row gets suppressed. And as a result, this acquires a horizontal type of orientation, this receptive field, and that explains the enhanced sensitivity to horizontal gratings. Yeah.
You randomize the position of the pattern.
Yeah.
Is that the catch pattern or the adaptation pattern?
Both, in both cases, yeah. Yeah, the probe, in all these experiments, the probe is going to be a mixture of the two adaptation patterns. And the probe is designed to tell you what the relative sensitivity is of the cell to the two kinds of stimuli that are used for adaptation. Yeah. But right, so to make ourselves independent of the fortuitous placement of the receptive field relative to the borders of the bars, we jittered the bars around. On a much finer grating. I think 1/4 the width of the bar was the resolution of the grating on which it jittered.
So these are presumably spike grates, these histograms.
What these are effectively are reverse correlations to the reverse correlations to the probe stimulus. So we. Let's see, is there a light here?
Well, maybe you don't necessarily bog us down.
Think of it this way. In your head, think of a model of the retinal ganglion cell as having four inputs, each with a linear filter feeding into one nonlinearity. Reverse correlation to these four inputs gives you sensitivity functions, effectively kernels for these four places in space, and from those you can derive the relative sensitivity to horizontal and vertical. So it's all in the context. The measurement we take is in the context of an LN model of ganglion cell responses. Okay, to kind of generalize this a little bit to the population of cells. We summarize how much of this dynamic predictive coding happens by a single number. We're going to look at how much the sensitivity to the horizontal grating increases when I adapt to vertical, and how much the sensitivity to the vertical grating changes. And I'll take the ratio of these two to produce a single index. And so remember, if that index is 1, then the cell either does nothing at all, or it changes the gain to horizontal gratings just as much as to vertical gratings, so it just changes its overall sensitivity. That's not very interesting. But if that adaptation index is positive, then it has changed, sorry, it's greater than 1, then it has changed the gain to the adapting stimulus. It has increased the sensitivity to the, decrease the sensitivity to the adapting stimulus and increase the sensitivity to the other stimulus. And that's the signature of predictive coding, to suppress the adapting stimulus and enhance the rare and unpredictable input. So when you look at a range of retinal ganglion cells from a salamander, you find that this adaptation index plotted on a log axis is significantly to the right of 1. And when we do some statistics on these responses, we find that about half of the cells that we record have a significantly an adaptation index that's significantly different from 1 at like the 1% significance level.
Is there any kind of cell type dependence?
In salamander, there is. So it's a bit subtle in that some types of adaptation happen for all cells, and other types of adaptation don't happen for all cells. The sort of the fast off cells seem to undergo all the adaptations that I'm going to show, but the on cells only a certain spatial or temporal adaptations. And we did similar experiments in rabbit retina, and again, you find that about half of the cells have an adaptation index that's significantly greater than 1. And you know, relative gain changes of a factor of 2 are not uncommon. So it means that the retina can change its gain, change its sensitivity to different visual features by a factor of 2, depending purely on the correlation structure of the environment. Yeah.
It
happens.
Is that a measurement problem, or are they actually being positive?
I would say the resolution of the measurement is probably 1 bin on either side of the center. So you know, these here, I would wonder whether they're actually doing something else. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah. It might be a failure of the model in measuring their sensitivities.
So, I mean, kind of getting back to questions of contrast. If you sort of think of the you know average linear filter of the cell as giving making there be an effective contrast for each stimulus that's not necessarily the same. And can you sort of, if that were true, then there would be maybe a component of this effect that would sort of, you know, kind of adjust the change in average contrast, which would be, you know, perhaps the same as you see with the, you know, uniform.
Shouldn't that affect?
That would affect the response to both. Would affect the response to both stimuli, though, right? That would lead to, if the cell was seeing an overall stronger input under one condition than the other, and that leads to desensitization or fatigue or whatnot, that should produce the same gain change to this stimulus as to that stimulus, and then that would be one. So the signature is really important, that the cell change its sensitivity in opposite directions to the two stimuli that are being compared in this adaptation experiment.
So if you look at the firing rate after transition to the new stimulus statistic, does it kind of go up and then fall back down?
That's interesting. So a good number of cells show that signature, where the average firing rate in this kind of flicker experiment kind of teeters along, and then when you change the stimulus, it jumps up and comes back down, and then when you change it again in the other direction, it jumps up and comes back down. But not all cells do that. For many cells, we actually don't see a change in the firing rate at all, or we see a dip in both cases, or something like that. But still, when you go back and right, I mean the more important thing is when you go back and ask how sensitive is the cell to one stimulus over the other stimulus. During that period, you find that it has changed its gain, even though you might not see that in the average firing rate. Yeah.
Now, why would you expect the horizontal adaptation to be bigger than the vertical?
I wouldn't expect that necessarily.
So, why do you think you find
it? I think it could be, you know, it could just be the peculiarity of what the shape of this ganglion cell's receptive field is. Right, so the little pink and blue bars are for one cell. So the peculiarity of how that receptive field is organized, both in terms of the shape of the center and the surround that the cell receives. Okay, I'm just going to quickly go through several other experiments of this type that we've tried. We wanted to see what is the kind of range of stimulus statistics that can lead to a change in coding of this type. And one experiment is shown here. We can compare two types of stimuli. One that's a flickering checkerboard, so the adjacent tiles in the checkerboard are flickering in counterphase. In the other case, all the tiles have the same intensity, are flickering with the same mean and same contrast. Sorry, assignment, same mean, same standard deviation as in this case. But in one case, the neighboring points are going in counterphase, in the other case, they're going in phase. So in some sense, this is the natural environment, if you want, a very little low-frequency spatial variation. And this is something very different that might be the fine gravel or sand, high spatial frequency variation. again, you can measure the ganglion cell sensitivity to the high-frequency stimulus and the low-frequency stimulus. And if you adapt now to a low-frequency environment, you find that sensitivity to high spatial frequency increases, but sensitivity to low spatial frequency stimulus decreases. So again, they go in opposite directions. And of course, when you adapt back in this direction, you find the opposite changes. So the rule, again, in general, is that the ganglion cells suppress the dominant stimulus and enhance the rare stimulus. And summarizing this again for a number of cells with this adaptation index, you find again that about half of the cells are significantly to the right of one.
So this is kind of related to the question about contrast. When you talk about suppressing the dominant stimulus, what you mean is you lower your gain along the axis. axis that has high variance?
Along the axis that had, right.
Using some small stimulus, you get the notion that there's this particular thing you were showing. But what you were actually showing was something dynamic that
right.
varies one of the many stimulus directions.
Right.
And when you have a high variance, you suppress it.
Yeah. Right. So that's a general rule, actually, that describes the phenomenology, and that also comes out of a model I'll talk about in a moment. But if you think of stimulus space as being this high-dimensional thing that has many directions in space and time, and the environment, stimulus environment, is described by a probability distribution in that space, the effects of this adaptation are to reduce the sensitivity along the directions that have high variance. Yeah. And so a stimulus environment like this one places all the variance in one direction, where x equals y, if x and y are the intensities of neighboring points, whereas this places all the variance in the direction where x is minus y, and the retina seems to shrink and reduce the sensitivity along the axis of high variance, and increases sensitivity along the axis of low variance. Yeah.
So isn't
psychophysically? Yeah. So psychophysically, this is a well-known effect that the human subjects become less sensitive to oriented gratings as a result of adaptation. So if you adapt the visual system with a horizontally lined grating and then test it, for example, by looking at the detection threshold contrast for gratings of different orientations, you find that the horizontal orientation is selectively suppressed and the vertical orientation, and you still remain sensitive to gratings of vertical orientation. So it's a well-known effect in psychophysics, and again, this is one of the instances where the neural processing underlying the effect has been sort of rigorously ascribed to cortex. The reason is that people have argued, in order to do this sort of adaptation, you really need line detectors. You need cells that are selective for particular orientation. And where do we find those cells? In visual cortex. And consequently, the adaptation to orientation must occur in visual cortex. I think that's fundamentally not true. I think I'll talk in a moment about mechanisms for adaptation that don't require that you have selective neurons to begin with in order to detect a particular stimulus feature.
Okay.
Yeah?
So here, if I understand correctly, really you're adapting to the statistics of edges. And so did you do the experiment of, say, showing two stimuli that have the same statistics of orientation of the edges, like two checkerboards, but that differ either by the size of the checkers or by the temporal correlation?
I'll show you temporal correlations in a moment. You can think of this as being a checkerboard with very large checkers,
but
right?
There you don't have any edges. No, I mean something where you still have, you double six. You don't go completely out of the.
Yeah, region. Yeah. We haven't done that experiment, but I'd expect that you would see this type of adaptation as well.
You would.
I would expect that. Yeah. Because I mean it's. I don't see it as being fundamentally distinct. I mean, again, this is a checkerboard with one checker.
No, you have a length scale, which is the receptive field length scale, which is imposed on the system.
Yeah. Well, okay. So let's say let's go in the other direction. If you made this finer and finer,
right.
Eventually there will come a point where the retina. Well, actually, the retina will stop to respond because you become smaller than all the receptive fields, and the retina will no longer see the difference between adjacent pixels.
It's interesting, within the window where you can, so say you take checkers where you have six checkers covering a receptive field versus three,
mm-hmm.
Then why would you adapt? Or do you yourself?
So it's an empirical question. I can't tell you whether adaptation happens, but based on what we've seen, I'd expect it.
In the time domain, but
what he's telling you essentially is that the thing you call low receptive field that has the length scale and the circle in the middle and the annulus that surrounds it is something that gets shaped dynamically by your.
Yeah.
No, but you have an overall length scale that doesn't change.
Oh, but the
it'll go from
it has range.
A few hundred microns. You won't jump to 2 millimeters after 5 millimeters.
So you're saying that there must be a length scale where if you had stimuli whose power was concentrated at special frequencies far outside some range, you wouldn't notice, you couldn't find that edge. Yeah.
No, I'm not saying that. That's very clear. But I'm saying if within that window, if you change the statistics of the lengths without changing the
But that was sort of Michael's problem. Right? He was arguing that, well, maybe there's a way to do this in which the effect all comes from the total power as seen through the receptive field, but that doesn't work. So what you'd be saying would be correct. Essentially, the model you're arguing for is, if I change the power spectrum in such a way as to conserve the amount of power that's inside the receptive field,
I wouldn't do anything. Right.
But that already doesn't work because since the receptive field starts out being circularly symmetric or close to it, if you just rotate the stimulus,
you don't rotate anything, just change the length.
Okay, it's I don't have the answer to whether this happens or not. So. But it's something one ought to explore. I mean, it'd be good to look at the range of length scales because ultimately that puts some constraints on the mechanism that might be implementing the whole thing. Yeah.
I thought I sort of did experiments like that, and at least this effect of binary jumps up and adapts down, and both transitions occur when you change the like a checkerboard different sizes of checkers. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't analyzed this way, so mm-hmm. the sensitivity per se changed.
All right. We've already talked about contrast adaptation earlier. That's something that happens on a timescale of seconds, and the same is true here. And actually, this is the signature from is a figure from an earlier experiment where we already started to see the signature of this kind of effect. And this is what Michael just mentioned. Again, we're switching from a uniform flickering stimulus to a counterphase checkerboard stimulus, looking at the firing rate of a ganglion cell, and it's kind of firing along. And when you switch the statistics, the firing rate jumps up briefly and decays. If you switch the statistics back, it jumps up again and decays. So this tells you that it's not true that one of these stimuli is stronger on average than the other, because the steady state firing rates are about the same, but there's a transient increase in firing at both transitions. And if you take that increase in firing to be as a signature of adaptation, you find that again it happens on a time scale of 5 or 10 seconds. And the same is true if we measure it with these, do the more sensitive measurement with these kernels to find out whether the ganglion cell is more sensitive to one or the other stimulus as it's responding. Again, the time constants are on the order of 3 or 5 seconds. Another type of correlation that we introduced was purely temporal correlations. So here the display is a uniform field, and the intensity is modulated again with a Gaussian distribution, but now we put correlations into the time sequence. In one case, intensity 0.60 milliseconds apart are strongly positively correlated, so they're almost the same in the sequence. In the other case, they're negatively correlated. And so you can see how this environment again allows for prediction. Yeah? You can predict the intensity at this point in time if you know what it was 60 milliseconds earlier. So you could do some predictive coding with this. And similarly here, you could do some predictive coding because you can predict this intensity if you know it 60 milliseconds earlier. But the rule for predictive coding is very different. Yeah? And in this case, you'd say subtract the same. In this case, you'd say subtract the opposite. Yeah? And so again, does the retina adjust to this? And here's an example of these reverse correlation functions for an individual retinal ganglion cell measured after adaptation to these two environments. And what you see is that the shape of this reverse correlation function has changed. Under this environment, it's strongly biphasic, which suggests that the cell subtracts what happened here from what happened here. And that's about 60 milliseconds apart. Under this environment, it's somewhat less biphasic. It's not, you know, it doesn't completely change into a monophasic kernel as you might expect based on the predictive rule here, but it's somewhat less biphasic, and that has a significant effect on the sensitivity of the neuron to these two types of stimuli. So again, as we adapt to the blue environment, let me call it like that, the sensitivity to blue slightly decreases, whereas the sensitivity to red increases, and vice versa when we adapt to this environment. And again, if you calculate the adaptation index for many neurons, you find that a good number of them are shifted to numbers greater than 1. And again, you know, indices of 2 or so are not uncommon. So again, the retina changes its differential sensitivity to these two stimuli by something on the order of a factor of 2. And finally, we tried a fiendish stimulus in which the display is a checkerboard, and one set of tiles is modulated with Gaussian random flicker. The other set of tiles uses the same flicker sequence but slightly delayed. Yeah, so what happens at the locations Y is 60 milliseconds delayed from what happens at locations X. And in the other environment, we do the same thing, but we move X, we delay X relative to Y. So again, these are environments that offer the opportunity for predictive coding, if that's what you want it to do, because you can predict the intensity at Y from the intensity at X 60 milliseconds earlier. It's a little bit like optic flow kind of a stimulus. Yeah. And here you can do it, but you have to apply the opposite rule. So the question again was, does the retina somehow change its spatiotemporal receptive fields so as to adjust in this way? And here's an example from an individual ganglion cell. Again, we adapt to the blue environment, and the sensitivity to blue stayed almost the same here. Sensitivity to red increased, though. And if you look at the adaptation index for many cells, you find that there's some tendency for adaptation index greater than 1. Simon, here's your cell that does the opposite. And obviously, this is somewhat stretching the capabilities of the system. We see somewhat less of an effect in the in this sort of pattern-selective adaptation.
There's a trend, it looks like, in all the things you showed where the thing you're, the sensitivity to whatever you're adapting to changes much less than the other one.
That can't be true because these are symmetric plots. So when you compare, look at what happens when you adapt to the red environment, the sensitivity decreases significantly. Yeah. So remember, the experiment is adapt to A, probe briefly, adapt to B, probe briefly, back to A, probe back to B. So you're adapting between two environments. There's no third reference environment in some sense that that we're using. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how this can come about. The general rule seems to be that the retina adjusts its processing depending on the correlations in the visual input, spatial correlations, temporal correlations, or space-time correlations. And the overall structure seems to be that the ganglion cells somehow suppress the prominent correlation structure and become more sensitive to rare features in the stimulus. Or as Bill put it, they reduce their sensitivity along the directions in stimulus space that have high variance and increase their sensitivity along other directions. So what might be a mechanism that brings this about? So as I mentioned earlier, this type of pattern adaptation has long been described in psychophysics, and in particular tested with oriented gratings. And the dominant explanation there has been that we have line detectors in the cortex that are responding to these oriented lines. And when you expose a human subject for a long period of time to a grating of one orientation, the line detectors for that orientation become fatigued. They fire a lot and gradually decrease their gain, whereas the line detectors that are not being driven have high sensitivity because they're not fatigued. And as a result, when you then test the system with gratings of different orientations, you find that the adapting orientation is much less effective at producing a threshold response than the orthogonal orientation, for example. So this has been the classic interpretation, that you have in the visual pathway, you have interneurons that are orientation selective, and when you expose the visual system to a vertical grating, the vertical line detectors gradually decrease their gain, the horizontal line detectors don't, and as a result, at the level of perception, or wherever at the output level of your experiment, you find that the sensitivity has, there's some horizontal preference to the sensitivity of the human subject. And vice versa, if you adapt to horizontal grating, now the horizontal detectors get fatigued, the vertical detectors don't. And as a result, the human subject has a net vertical sensitivity. Now, if we were to apply this idea to the retina, we would say there are some interneurons in the retina that are orientation selective. And these interneurons get fatigued by the stimulus that drives them hard. And some of those pathways converge at the level of the ganglion cell. And that's why we see oriented receptive fields in ganglion cells after adaptation. So the problem with this idea is that if you actually stick an electrode into interneurons and ask, are they good candidates for this sort of explanation, you find that interneurons tend to not be very orientation selective. They're not line detectors. So for example, the most plausible interneuron would be a bipolar cell, and these tend to have very round receptive fields. And we looked into this carefully and actually estimated how orientation selective the bipolar cells are that we record from, and plug that into this kind of model where the gain changes for neurons that are being driven hard and doesn't change for neurons that are being driven weakly. And the best you can predict from that kind of explanation is about a 1% change in the differential gain of ganglion cells to oriented stimuli of either vertical or horizontal gratings. Yeah.
Have you guys actually seen amacrine cells that have very elongated processes?
There are some amacrine cells like that, but the elongated processes tend to be output, tend to be the axons. So there's a type of amacrine cell that has a sort of local dendritic field of inputs, and then sends a sparse set of axons out. And sometimes if there's only two, then that looks like an oriented arrangement. But their receptive fields tend to be around as well. So one problem with this hypothesis as applied to retina is that there just aren't any good candidates for interneurons that are line selective to the point that they would sustain or produce this kind of pattern selective adaptation. Another issue with this kind of mechanism is that for each of the correlations that we've tested and that the retina somehow seems to adapt to, you'd have to postulate that there's an interneuron that's selective for this type of thing and then fatigues when you expose it to, let's say, left to right motion and not when you expose it to right to left motion or something like that. So you get yourself in trouble because you need a very large number of these pattern selective interneurons to account for the large number of phenomena of adaptation type phenomena. So what's an alternative? I want to discuss an alternative that is a little bit like a network that's been proposed and discussed by Peter Foldyak and Horace Barlow that makes use of plasticity not at the level of individual neurons, of fatigue and gain control of individual cells, but at the level of synapses. And I'm going to translate this idea into retina in the following way. Think of a retinal ganglion cell that gets inhibited by surrounding amacrine cells. And so the inhibition from these amacrine cells leads to a center surround receptive field of the ganglion cell. It's excited by light in the center and inhibited by light in the surround because of these amacrine cell receptive fields. And now let's place this network into an environment of vertical flickering grating. And I'm going to postulate some rules for how the synapses between amacrine cells and ganglion cells change. And the rule is this. If the two neurons, the amacrine cell and the ganglion cell, are strongly correlated in their activity, they tend to do the same thing over time, the inhibitory synapse should strengthen. Whereas if they're anti-correlated, the inhibitory synapse should weaken. So what happens then in this kind of stimulus environment is that these two synapses get stronger and these two synapses get weaker. And as a result, the ganglion cell is more strongly inhibited from above and below than from right to left. And so it achieves this horizontally oriented receptive field, becomes less sensitive to vertical gratings and more sensitive to horizontal gratings. And vice versa, of course, if we place the network into a horizontally oriented environment, these two synapses strengthen, these two weaken, and the ganglion cell becomes vertically selective.
This would depend on the phase. I mean, if phase is reversed, then
Sorry, what do you mean by phase?
A shift in phase of the radiation.
Sorry, so light and dark here, each of the bars is flickering all the time. So it's a counterphase grating. So over time, the light bars and the dark bars interchange and flicker in opposite directions.
So why confirms the left and right
so the
So the
rule is a correlation-based rule. The synapse strengthens if the amacrine cell and ganglion cell are correlated in time. Both of them will go up and down because the grating flickers, but they're going up and down together because they're looking at the same vertical bar. Yeah. Whereas these two neurons will be anti-correlated because the grating flickers in counterphase. They're anti-correlated. They will tend to do the opposite thing because of their bipolar cell input, and that weakens this inhibitory synapse. Make sense? So again, the rule for synaptic plasticity is anti-Hebbian in the sense that the Hebbian rule for synaptic change is that two neurons that are correlated should strengthen mutual excitation, and we want the opposite to happen. We want two neurons that are correlated to actually inhibit each other, or it's unidirectional. The amacrine cell inhibits the ganglion cell. So that is an anti-Hebbian type of mechanism, at least formally speaking. And you can think of it qualitatively as the amacrine cells are effectively trying to predict the ganglion cell signal from what happens in the surround. And these two amacrine cells are successful, and these two amacrine cells are unsuccessful in predicting the ganglion cell output. And so the successful ones get rewarded with a strong inhibitory synapse, as a result of which their successful predictions get subtracted from the ganglion cell input, and the ganglion cell encodes the difference between the local intensity and the prediction. So in this way, you can see that this network really implements a dynamic version of predictive coding, because it's constantly trying out different predictions for what the ganglion cell does, and the successful ones get subtracted. Yeah?
Because it's inhibiting it.
Right. So as the predictive coding starts to take hold, the ganglion cell output becomes weaker and weaker. Right. It actually varies less and less because you're subtracting effective predictions, and so the ganglion cell response will become weaker overall, and this, of course, has to settle into some steady state. And I'll formalize it in a moment, and I'll show you what the steady state is. So you need, of course, you always need some finite response from the ganglion cell still in order to maintain the correlation signal that keeps the synapses. Yeah. All right. So an attractive version of attractive feature of this hypothesis is that the adaptation happens at synapses, not at individual neurons. And of course, there are a lot more synapses in the network than there are neurons. And each synapse can effectively try out a different kind of spatiotemporal correlation depending on the properties of the two neurons it's connected to, and in that way implement a different form of prediction. So because the amacrine cells come in a good variety of types that have different spatial receptive fields, different temporal properties, and so on, you can, in principle, explore a large variety of different predictions and implement them in this dynamic way. And so you don't have to postulate a separate neuron, separate selective pattern selective neuron for each pattern adaptation that you discover down the line. So We formalized this partly in order to think about the kinds of questions that Ila raised. In a simple linear model of the inner retina, so the idea is that there's a set of bipolar cells that feeds a population of ganglion cells. And there are two types of synapses, two types of connections from bipolar to ganglion cells. One is excitatory, and the other one is inhibitory. And the inhibitory ones obviously go through the amacrine cells as interneurons. But I'm going to treat them as though the bipolar cell connected directly to a ganglion cell with an inhibitory synapse. And we're going to say that the excitatory synapses are fixed. They're kind of hardwired. But the inhibitory synapses are modifiable, and they're going to be modifiable in the way that I talked about using this anti-Hibbian rule. So there are two things one has to write down. One is, how does the network actually process the input from bipolar cells into the output of ganglion cells? And here we'll say, we'll assume this is a purely linear processing. So the individual ganglion cell simply weights the input, all the inputs xj, by the strength of the synapses from neuron j to output neuron I. And the synapses, again, are excitatory, and there's an excitatory component and an inhibitory component. And then the second rule we need is how the synapses change. And so these modifiable synapses Aij change according to this dynamics. There is a simple decay term here. And this just ensures that the retina doesn't remember forever and can actually is allowed to forget what happened in the very distant past. And then there's this correlation term here that correlates the output of ganglion cell I with the input of bipolar cell J. And if the two are strongly correlated, then that synapse becomes more negative. Yeah, so that's the direction of the rule. The synapse has to become more inhibitory when the pre- and postsynaptic neurons are strongly correlated. And then, so you can see this is a fairly simple system. You can pretty much just work with the Abbott and Day on the textbook and plug in the linear algebra that comes out of these equations and figure out what the time-dependent solution is for the set of synapses, and as a result, what the time dependence is of the sensitivity of the retinal ganglion cell, depending on the correlation structure of the stimulus.
Are there all ganglion cells?
Sorry?
Are there all ganglion cells?
Yeah, amacrine cells come in both on and off types.
So they should have.
They should have.
They both once. No,
I think the polarity to the light input doesn't matter. The Hebbrol ought to be the same. Yeah.
Does that work? I mean, both of them work. What is one is on and another is off?
Well, again, if the in that case, the off amacrine is going to be anti-correlated with the on ganglion cell, and therefore its synapse ought to weaken. You don't want that neuron to inhibit the ganglion cell. So same rule at the level of synapse, regardless of what the functional type is. And again, the principle is just the neurons that make the right prediction should get rewarded with an inhibitory synapse. It doesn't matter how they accomplish that prediction. All right, just to point out that this actually does the right thing, here's a simple example one can calculate. Again, the solution is analytical, right? It's just linear algebra. There, you don't have to do any numerics. You can write down the closed form solution. Here's an example of a modeled ganglion cell that's connected to a 4x4 array of bipolar cells. And I'm drawing the receptive field here as the sensitivity of the ganglion cell to each of the bipolar cells. And in this network I showed you a moment ago, there are initially only four connections to the center 2x2 patch of bipolar cells. These are excitatory connections. So this would be the ganglion cell's default receptive field. And now we're going to ask how, via these modifiable synapses, the receptive field changes as you impose different kinds of visual stimuli on this network. And here are the different kinds of stimuli. In this case, this is a zero stimulus, just a gray flat screen. Nothing happens. In this case, the stimulus is a randomly flickering checkerboard. In this case, it's a flickering uniform field that goes up up and down with a flickering waveform. Here we have a counterphase checkerboard. That was another stimulus we tried in experiments, right? Here we have a vertically oriented grating, here horizontally oriented grating, and back to no stimulus at all. And what I'm plotting for you here is the sensitivity of this ganglion cell, this model ganglion cell, to these different kinds of stimuli, the uniform field, the checkerboard, the vertical, and the horizontal grating. As a result of adaptation, this sensitivity changes with time. So for example, let's go through this. If we start with no stimulus, the sensitivity to all these four things is equal, to all these four types of stimuli is equal. Then we put on a randomly flickering checkerboard where all the pixels are uncorrelated. The sensitivity declines to all of these stimulus directions. And this is something that is sort of like contrast adaptation that we've studied before. If we now put on a flickering uniform field, then the sensitivity to the uniform field plummets down, whereas the sensitivity to all these other types of stimuli, these different directions in stimulus space, recovers back to one. And if we put on the counterface checkerboard, the sensitivity to that stimulus declines, whereas the sensitivity to the uniform field recovers. So you can see how the network selectively alters the sensitivity to the type of stimulus that it's being adapted to, while retaining sensitivity to other stimulus directions that are orthogonal to it. Another cute feature that comes out of this is that the adaptation to an increase in variance is fast, whereas the recovery is slow. And that's a general phenomenology that we've found in many different systems. Now in the fly retina and in the vertebrate retina and also in human subjects adapting to contrast, that the onset of adaptation is quite a bit faster than the recovery from adaptation. And it comes naturally out of this simple model of synaptic plasticity. So I should stop here. This is more or less where we are, and we're now testing this hypothesis for the mechanism of these adaptive phenomena to actually try to get a hold of these synapses explicitly and see whether the transmission from amacrine cells to ganglion cells is in fact modified by the statistical structure of a visual stimulus. We have some indications that these synapses are important. If you block inhibition in the retina by pharmacologically by applying blockers of GABAergic and glycinergic transmission, you actually find that dynamic predictive coding goes away. Here's an example of an experiment where we did the horizontal vertical adaptation, and you find a lot of neurons with a high adaptation index. If you repeat the experiment on the same neurons but blocking inhibitory transmission, these large numbers largely go away, and in fact there's a number of neurons that seem to do the opposite thing. So inhibition is probably very important for this process of dynamic predictive coding, and we'd like to know now explicitly whether these synapses between amacrine and ganglion cells are modified in the way that we would predict.
Don't you still need it goes in the opposite direction? Doesn't it still have to be circuit to kind of do this? Just in the wrong direction?
What could produce this? So these are selective blockers of inhibition. Yeah, I mean it's possible that you have different kinds of adaptation in the excitatory synapses. I'd rather not get into trying to explain what happens in a few neurons to the left of one, but eventually that. I mean it's an interesting question also methodologically. Is maybe as Bill suggested, is maybe the LN model not appropriate for those neurons, and they're really doing something different. Anyway, let me just summarize and go cancel some of this here. We've talked about the retinal adaptation and several instances, several forms of adaptation in the retina, and the general theme seems to be that the retina tries to discard signals that are predictable. So we saw this already in the context of light adaptation where it's predictable that at any given point during the day that nothing happens in this range of intensities. They're all over here. And consequently, the retina doesn't bother to actually encode these intensities. And in a more subtle way, With regards to spatial and temporal correlations in the stimulus, we find that the retina engages in these, on average, engages in the sort of center surround differentiation in order to discard spatial predictable signals, and in a biphasic temporal response to discard constant signals in time. And what we found now is that the rules that the retina uses for making these predictions are to some extent dynamic. It can adjust to the structure, spatial-temporal structure of the visual environment, and change the rules. And the common trend seems to be to try and perform predictive coding under the new statistics of the visual environment, and subtract predicted signals in a more general fashion. And we've talked about two hypotheses for how this might work. And I think because we actually know quite a bit about retinal circuitry and the interneurons and the synapses that exist, the sort of parallel pathways hypothesis, which is really the dominant idea in the literature, is probably not tenable for what goes on in the retina. But a plausible alternative is a system in which the synapses between neurons are adaptive rather than individual neurons changing their gain. And we think that this might account for a large variety of adaptations of the type that we see. And we're looking more carefully now at whether these synapses actually change their strength. Thanks a lot. Yeah?
Explain
adaptation to XT correlated, sort of motion. I mean, that means the amacrine cell must somehow have a motion. No, not necessarily. So you could have an amacrine cell over here whose signal is slightly delayed. Relative to the ganglion cell over here. And in a situation where there's systematic motion in this direction, this amacrine cell signal will be strongly correlated with this ganglion cell signal because of the temporal sequence and the delay in this pathway. And if you strengthen its inhibitory synapse, it will tend to suppress sensitivity to that motion while not affecting sensitivity to this motion. So you can produce motion adaptation from neurons that are intrinsically not direction selective or even selective for motion in any way, as long as you place the adaptation in the synapses.
And as long as you have a population of amacrine cells with different latencies.
Yes, right. So that's important, that you have a range of latencies, a range of spatial locations, and also sizes of receptive fields. And you know, the amacrine cells are, they're probably the most diverse population of neurons in the retina, and there's still quite a bit of mystery about what are they all doing, and why do we have so many different types, and who knows, maybe this is what they're doing, trying to predict ganglion cell output. Yeah, Ila?
If I work in a company and I get a raise each year, which is, you know, 3% of a raise, then if I get a raise in 1 year that's more than my previous last year's salary, but lower than that extrapolated earnings, like, I'm disappointed. So it means that you can also have baselines that are higher order things, like, you know, you can predictably notice that things are changing, you know, linearly, things are changing quadratically. And the question is, in the visual system, first of all, you know, psychophysically, do we have this ability to predictively change these higher order statistics, predict these higher order statistics of change? And then do you think there's any other complication happening in the retina, or is it higher levels?
Okay, let me go back to something you said earlier. The sort of default hypothesis that nothing changes is, I think, the hypothesis that applies to the average visual scene. What I've shown you is that the retina can adopt other default hypotheses. Yeah. So, for example, after adaptation to the vertical grating, the default hypothesis is that this patch does the opposite thing of this patch. Yeah. And then that hypothesis can be used for prediction. With regards to actually a linear trend,
And then a quadratic trend, or whatever. Yeah, the trend in the first derivative, the trend in the second.
Secondary and so on. Yeah.
No, but no, question is, does it happen, right? Maybe rats can't predict. Maybe you do that.
Well, I'm just trying to think of psychophysics that.
So
an interesting psychophysical after effect is if you look at a patch whose intensity varies with a sawtooth waveform. Of course, you can't keep increasing it. There's a limit to that. But a patch whose intensity increases with a sawtooth waveform, and then you turn that off, then the percept is that things are getting dimmer. That the area in the field that you were looking at is getting dimmer. So it's an after effect that you could explain as adaptation to a steady increase in intensity. And then the after effect is that, and again, that's been explained with the same line that somewhere in the visual system there must be brightening detectors, neurons that are excited by a steady increase, and those get fatigued during the sawtooth stimulus, and so because they're fatigued, the dimming detectors take over, and they give you the impression that things are getting the after effect is getting dimmer all the time. Interesting question whether an experiment like that could be explained with an alternate mechanism that doesn't invoke the pattern selected neurons.
If you can adapt to, if you're moving and you can adapt to it, so you can adapt to the optic flow, presumably you can adapt to different velocities by using different latencies. You're adapting to different linear flows. And then presumably you can adapt to acceleration just by using different latencies at different positions on the retina. And there you adapt to an acceleration.
Yeah.
So, I mean, using these mechanisms, you could think it's a...
But then instead of multiplying the number of features protecting neurons, you can multiply the number of synapses.
Yeah.
Not nearly as steeply, but
there are lots of synapses.
Right. A lot of synapses compared to a number of neurons. But, I mean, again, Garrett, as you said earlier, I wouldn't be surprised if something similar happens in cortical networks as well. And a lot of the adaptation can actually be placed at synapses rather than the input-output relationship of an individual neuron.
It's starting to emerge as the theme, cortical theme.
Right? Yeah,
the cortical depression.
Yeah. And, I mean, Barlow and Foliak proposed this some time ago, right? That these anti-Hibbian networks could be used in order to, suppress dominant structures and kind of ignore what seems predictable and what seems constant and filter out novelty, and then you might follow that up with a Hibbian network that detects coincidences among these novelty detectors in order to form a higher set of features. So I wouldn't be surprised if one found ultimately in cortical networks this kind of synaptic plasticity operating. Maybe more among the inhibitory interneurons. yeah?
So the time scale that's given is 10 seconds. Is there anything comparable?
It's the people who measure synaptic plasticity they tend to be focused on long-term effects. Long-term potentiation, half-hour time course or something like that. There are, of course, a lot of short-term effects, paired pulse facilitation and also short-term depression of synapses. I haven't come across a report of short-term correlation-based, pre-post correlation-based plasticity, particularly in inhibitory synapses. But I think there's room in that space that hasn't been explored experimentally, especially because a lot of focus has been on excitatory synapses when it comes to synaptic plasticity. mean, there are candidate, you can imagine that a candidate retrograde transmitters that inhibitory synapses and so on. I gave a talk about this recently with Richard Chen was in the audience, and he said, oh, I have a mechanism for you on any time scale. So he seemed confident that something could be worked out, but one would still want to observe it experimentally, which is why we'd like to actually go in there with electrodes now and stimulate individual amacrine cells and see whether the strength from amacrine cell to, the strength of transmission from amacrine to ganglion cell changes.
Is it possible that like some kind of short-term boost
will be there? If it establishes itself on the timescale of 5 seconds or so, that would be the right. If that's what you mean by short-term, that's what we're looking for. Plasticity purely dependent on presynaptic activity or so. That won't work. Right. Okay. So. Yeah. There's kind of an intermediate proposal, which is taking the parallel pathways hypothesis. Okay, taking this hypothesis and replacing these boxes, and instead of supposing that they're individual interneurons, suppose that they're synaptic terminals. And so synaptic terminals from one interneuron to the ganglion cell. Yeah. So that alone isn't very successful, but what we think could work is the kind of connectivity that I actually showed a little earlier in the talk. One synaptic arrangement that you find prominently between bipolar and amacrine and ganglion cells is a situation where a bipolar cell excites a ganglion cell and an amacrine cell makes an inhibitory terminal right onto presynaptically onto that bipolar cell terminal. Yeah. So imagine now that the bipolar cell terminal undergoes some presynaptic depression. So when it's been very active for some time, the number of vesicles gets depleted, and so the gain decreases for synaptic transmission. because the activity at that terminal depends on both bipolar cell activity and this amacrine cell activity, effectively that variable is able to sense the correlation between these two neurons. And so if this undergoes some presynaptic depression, then it would allow you, it's a mechanism for making the strength of the synapse contingent on the correlation between two inputs. And we're still working through that, but we're thinking that that kind of effect could account for a lot of the phenomena. And so, again, ultimately one wants to really try to observe these synaptic connections directly by stimulating the presynaptic neurons and seeing what the ganglion cell does and asking whether you can manipulate the strength of either this terminal or, as we've postulated, the amacrine to ganglion cell synapse by the structure of the visual stimulus. But I think this is a sort of intermediate version of the two hypotheses, where the adaptation is in individual channels, but the channels are synaptic terminals, not neurons.
In your model, you said that you reach a steady state at some point. So if you estimate the number of action potentials that you have available in those 5 or 10 seconds during which you think adaptation occurs, you have enough, many of them, to get to that steady state.
In terms of driving the correlation-based mechanism with those action potentials. Yeah. Cancel spike. Amacrine cells, I mean, some or many of them spike. Whether that's going to be a spike-dependent mechanism or not, then, I'm not sure. It could well, you know, be sub-threshold correlation as well. Yeah, I don't really have an opinion on it. But in 5 seconds, I mean, you would typically get 10 or 15 spikes from a ganglion cell, so you could probably correlate reasonably with that.
Good question. Have you tried blocking GABA B receptors?
No, not selectively.
Don't you think it's rather surprising that if you block inhibition of the restaurant, it still works? As you know, we've got this massive background signal, it's all meant to be pulled out by potency.
Well, it works so-so. If you block inhibition in the retina, I mean, activity increases tremendously. The ganglion cells suddenly have a lot of spontaneous activity. The sensitivity to visual stimuli increases. And so you're recording a lot more spikes suddenly. You can still measure the differential sensitivity to two different types of stimuli, which is what the measurement is based on here in this adaptation experiment. But the retina is obviously in a very different state from what it was before. No, I mean, inhibition is really essential, in fact.
Oh, no, you would think that the retina would just saturate at a very low light level.
No, it's,
yeah.
Yeah. Also, I mean, in the salamander retina, certainly it's been established that horizontal cell transmission isn't affected by picrotoxin. So, in fact, it is a mysterious mechanism of transmission that may well be have something to do with these electrical proposals. So I bet that that synapse still works under these conditions. In the retina, it's probably the amacrine cell effects are probably mostly eliminated with picrotoxin and strychnine.
It doesn't affect GABA B.
Doesn't affect GABA B, and you think that's a major component of transmission?
Could be. I mean, they're still all, you know, emitting GABA.
Yeah, sure. It's worth playing with, but again, I think the adaptive effects are really strongly diminished by GABA A and GABA B block, GABA A and C block. Yeah. All right, thanks a lot.